welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision. In today's program, a look at the history of one of the most contested pieces of real estate on the planet.
The site in the centre of Jerusalem's Old City is known to Jews as the Temple Mount. It's known as Haram al-Sharif to Muslims, their third holiest site after Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia.
In Jerusalem, dozens of people have been left injured after Israeli riot police and Palestinian demonstrators clashed at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The protest was sparked by an Israeli decision to start archaeological work near the mosque.
For 24 hours straight, Muslim clerics have been spreading the word. The message was, it's your duty to defend the Al-Aqsa Mosque from Israeli aggression.
Conflict over the Temple Mount, or Haram al-Sharif, has been a constant feature of life in Jerusalem since 1967. Situated in the middle of the Old City, it contains two major Muslim sites, the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. While the Haram al-Sharif is controlled by a Muslim religious authority, the Israeli government claims the right to enter the compound for security reasons. In order to gain access to the compound, the Israelis must enter via the Moor's Gate. And the recent conflict is over work being carried out by the Israelis at that gate. In Rear Vision today, we're going to try to piece together the history of the Temple Mount or Haram al-Sharif and its political and geographic position in modern-day Jerusalem. Bernard Wasserstein is Professor of History at the University of Chicago and the author of Divided Jerusalem.
Jerusalem is a city that's built on hills. It's spread out over those hills and in the valleys between the hills. At the heart of the city is what is called the Old City, and it is surrounded by high stone walls that were built by the Turkish Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent in the 16th century. And those walls gird the old city. They remain intact and they're one of the great monuments of the city. The old city is divided into four quarters: a Muslim quarter, a Christian quarter, a Jewish quarter, and an Armenian quarter. In the Muslim quarter is the Temple Mount.
The Temple Mount is a huge artificial platform created by the Jewish king Herod. As Father Jerome Murphy O'Connor, eminent biblical scholar and resident of Jerusalem for 44 years, explains.
This is a huge platform built by Herod the Great, and it would be about the size of a rather big football ground, or say the Melbourne cricket ground. That size, an immense esplanade, and on it, two religious buildings. Over the Holy of Holies, the Dome of the Rock, and then the big prayer mosque, the Al-Aqsa, at the further end.
The platform is sacred to both Jews and Muslims. Jews because it was the site of the first and the second temples, and where Abraham offered his son as a sacrifice. To Muslims because it is the place to which the Prophet Muhammad first prayed, and where he is said to have ascended into heaven. Despite these competing religious claims, for most of the last 1,300 years, Muslims and Jews have not been in conflict over the platform. So why are they now? Before we get to that question, we need to go back to the time of the Jewish kings of David and Solomon, when the platform was literally carved out of the hills of Jerusalem and the first Jewish temple was built.
The oldest part of Jerusalem was the little city of the Jebusites, which was on a ridge between two valleys. And when David took that over, it was extended to the north. And Solomon, his son, decided to take the top of the hill and build the first temple, which meant that to get a flat surface, he had to surround the top of the hill by retaining walls that he then filled, and you had a nice flat surface. And that was repeated in the subsequent rebuildings, except that Herod went much further, doubling the size of the original temple, which meant he had to cut further into the rock on the north and then build huge retaining walls on the other three sides. And those are the walls that have survived to the present day. They were so well built, so strong. Some of the stones are 400 tons, that it would have been virtually impossible to knock them down.
The first temple was built about 1,000 years before Christ, and that survived until the 6th century before Christ, when it was captured and ransacked by the Persians, who conquered Palestine and Jerusalem in the year 587 before Christ. It was rebuilt after the Jews were allowed to return from exile in Babylonia in 516, and then it was successively rebuilt and enlarged, culminating in the temple of Herod, who was king of Judea at the time of Christ.
We have absolutely no evidence of the first three temples, that of Solomon, that of Zerubbabel, and then that of the Maccabees. All the evidence we have, all the visible evidence, is from the temple of Herod, but no one doubts that was Jewish. He was a Jewish king of a Jewish nation, and his temple, we're told, was on the site of the ancient temple.
Herod's temple was destroyed by the Romans in the year 70 AD, and the Jews were banished from Jerusalem. For the next 500 to 600 years, the area of the Temple Mount was laid to waste.
It was just left wasteland. The city used it as a quarry. There were beautifully cut stones, and we're told that they used the open areas to grow cucumbers. And when the Christians, the Byzantines, took control, they viewed it as the proof that God's favor had passed from the Jews to the Christians, because God had permitted his temple to be destroyed.
In 638 AD, the Muslim army led by the Caliph Omar, commander of the faith, conquered Jerusalem. Unlike the Romans, he didn't destroy any of the city's religious sites, but did decide to build a mosque on the wasteland that was the Temple Mount.
Omar had a very sensible policy to captured nations. If you don't make trouble, nothing will happen to you. So he gave the famous guarantee to the Christians of Jerusalem, if you are quiet, we will not take a church, we will not take a monastery, we will not take a convent. And so the only space that was available was this huge empty space of the old Jewish temple that the Christians had never used. But also for them, it was the site of the holy house, that is the Jewish temple. And Islam venerated Judaism and Christianity as its predecessors in revelation. Each received a partial revelation, Judaism first, then that was improved by Christianity, and then the final perfect product was Islam. And so at the beginning, Islam made no effort to convert Jews and Christians, but they believed, because Muhammad believed, that Jerusalem was a holy place. When he began, he prayed facing towards Jerusalem. And it was only 2 years later that he began to pray facing towards Mecca.
The Muslims called the platform the Haram al-Sharif. Oleg Graba is a retired professor of Islamic art and archaeology and the author of The Dome of the Rock.
The Al-Aqsa Mosque were probably very early. We don't know exactly, but probably in the 640s, 650s. The Dome of the Rock is dated 691. And it is very simple. It's a cylinder over the rock in the middle, surrounded by two octagons. So it's two octagonal areas around the cylinder with four entrances, equal in size. There is no one entrance superior or more important than the others. So in other words, it's a kind of building that is almost perfectly symmetrical in whatever direction you want to put it. And it is magnificently decorated. One of its peculiarities is that both outside and inside, it was decorated with color, with mosaics, which is very rare at that time. It was a building made to make an impact. It was not simply something in which you do something, but it's a building you were supposed to look at.
The Dome of the Rock is built on bedrock, and so it's extremely solid. Also, it's mathematically a beautifully shaped building, so I think it sways with great regularity. It's not terribly big. The inner circle is only 66 feet, whereas the Al-Aqsa Mosque at the southern end is resting on fill, because, remember, these are the big retaining walls that make a flat platform possible, and that the Al-Aqsa is built on that fill, and of course there's a lot more movement, and it suffers a lot more damage.
Jews had been banished from Jerusalem by the Romans, but after the Arab conquest, they were allowed to return.
Islam permitted Jews to return immediately, and from that period, 638, up to the arrival of the Crusaders in 1099, the population of Jerusalem was roughly one-third Muslims, one-third Jews, one-third Christians. In many ways, they were the best years in Jerusalem in terms of interfaith relationships. But by that stage, the attention of Judaism had swung away from sacrifices in the temple to obedience to the law. And I'm not aware of any effort during the early Islamic period to reclaim the Temple Mount or to try and build a new temple.
You're listening to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and via the web with me, Annabelle Quince. In today's program, we're taking a look at the history of one of the most contested pieces of real estate on the planet, the Temple Mount or Haram al-Sharif. In 1099, the Crusaders captured Jerusalem, and the Haram al-Sharif was converted to a Christian holy place.
When the Crusaders took over Jerusalem, the Temple Mount, as always, because of its great fortifications, was the Islamic defenders' last bastion. But Tancred was so quick with his 100 knights that once they got the breachhead on the wall, he went straight for the Temple Mount, and before the defenders realized what happened, he was in possession. And then it became a Christian holy place. The mosque, the Dome of the Rock, became a church, and a monastery was built just on the north side of it. And on the south side, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, that became the royal palace, and subsequently the headquarters of the Templars. And the Crusaders were preparing to build a big church on the Temple Mount, but fortunately hadn't gotten around to it before Saladin retook Jerusalem in the autumn of 1187.
Saladin took down the Christian artefacts and returned the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque to their former Islamic glory. Like Omar, Saladin was tolerant of other faiths, and while Jews and Christians were not given the same status as Muslims, they were allowed to worship and live in Jerusalem.
The Jewish community had its own life. In the city of Jerusalem, they had their synagogues, they had their tribunals, but they were very little involved with the mount where the temple used to be, until the 16th century, where they started coming and lament the fall of the temple. Now, why and how this started, I'm not absolutely sure of. And that remained until 1967.
So explain to us the connection with the Wailing Wall. Where does it fit into the geography?
The Wailing Wall is part of the western wall of the temple built by Herod. So it was the outer walls of Herod's temple. And Herod's construction is magnificent masonry. So this still now remains in superb condition. And it was the most accessible, the most visible part of that wall. Everything else was surrounded by other buildings, other activities. It's the only one that was very clearly visible.
We have reports of Jews going to lament the destruction of the temple there quite early on. I don't know when the first one is, but it's quite early on. And Jews throughout the ages went to Jerusalem and prayed at the Western Wall. But it's only in the late 19th and 20th century that it becomes a political issue. Really only in the 20th century that it becomes a focus for political issue, and that's because it becomes linked with political Zionism.
The Islamic rule of Jerusalem ended with the defeat of the Ottoman Empire after World War I, and the city became part of the British Mandate over Palestine. From the latter part of the 19th century, European Jews, many Zionists, began arriving in Palestine. Neither the British or these Jewish immigrants questioned the continuing control of the Haram al-Sharif by the Muslim community. There was, however, an attempt by some Zionists to buy the area in front of the Wailing Wall.
There was what was called a Moroccan trust, which owned the houses or hovels that existed immediately in front of the wall. At that time, there was only a very narrow passageway next to the wall, between the wall and these houses. And there was an attempt to buy the wall by the Zionist organization with the help of funds from the Rothschilds. The wall itself belonged, according to Muslim law, to that trust, that religious trust. But those efforts failed.
Did those attempts cause tensions between the communities?
Well, there was suspicion on the part of the Muslims, of some Muslims, that the Zionists hoped to rebuild the temple. But the Zionists assured them that was not the case, and that all they wanted was to ensure that Jews could worship at the Western Wall, which is not on the mount, but it is below it.
In 1948, the British withdrew from Palestine, and the Jewish Provisional Government proclaimed the State of Israel. War with the Arabs followed and ended in the partitioning of Jerusalem.
The whole of the Old City became part of Jordanian East Jerusalem. Jerusalem was divided between 1948 and 1967 between the Jordanian government and the Israelis. The Jordanians ruled East Jerusalem and the Israelis ruled West Jerusalem. All the Arabs were driven out of or fled West Jerusalem. All the Jews were driven out of or fled East Jerusalem. So the Jewish quarter, which was in East Jerusalem, inside the Old City, holy part of Jordanian Jerusalem, was not accessible to Jews, and therefore the Western Wall, which is just next to the Jewish quarter, was also not accessible to Jews, at least not to Israeli Jews.
This all changed in 1967, after the Six-Day War.
But the most bitter struggle is in the area of Jerusalem. A short, fierce battle, the forces break into the Old City, and then they reach the holiest objective of all, the Wailing Wall. The traditional ram's horn, the shofar, which has heralded all great Jewish events in history for thousands of years, is heard once again on the holiest site in Jewry.
On the day on which the Temple Mount was captured, in June 1967, the chief rabbi of the Israeli army, a man called Rabbi Goren, who was a very nationalistic figure, went up onto the Temple Mount and blew a ram's horn, signifying a kind of victory salute on the Temple Mount. But he was reprimanded, and in fact one of the first decisions by the then Minister of Defense, General Dayan, was that the status quo, the religious status quo on the Temple Mount, would be preserved.
And why do you think that decision was made? Why did they decide to let the status quo stay?
Israel was very concerned at that time to show that it could be a fit ruler of a city holy to three religions, that it could guarantee freedom of worship of members of the three religions and free access to the holy places of all three religions.
The first thing Israel did when it took control in 67 was to demolish all the Moorish houses in front of the Western Wall and to create a whole new big open space, a piazza. And you see the shift, it's no longer the Wailing Wall, it's now become the Western Wall, because of course times were much better. But they realized there would be chaos throughout the Arab world if they attempted to take over the Temple Mount. And I think the politicians were delighted when the grand rabbis issued a proclamation forbidding Jews to go on the Temple Mount, because they might stray into an area where they were forbidden to go. Remember that only the high priest could enter the Holy of Holies. But since no one knew exactly where the Holy of Holies was, then any Jew or modern Israeli wandering around might enter the Holy of Holies. You see the problem?
Not all Jews, however, followed that logic. After the Israelis gained control of Jerusalem in 1967, a small number of Jews began arguing that a new Jewish temple should and could be built on the Temple Mount.
It emerged, first of all, only among a small group of extremists. And secondly, it only emerged after 1967. One barely hears such a thing voiced before 1967. So it is a result following the capture of the Temple Mount. It is not a reason for the capture of the Temple Mount, if you see what I mean. And even after 1967, there have been very strong voices, even among the Orthodox Jewish section of the population, in fact, especially among the Orthodox Jewish section of the population, rejecting such ideas. A few fanatics from time to time went up there and tried to hold prayer meetings. And that is one of the things that led to trouble and led to riots. And then there were attempts by some fanatics to do even worse things. One of them burst in 1982 and started with a machine gun and started shooting people in the Dome of the Rock. And others tried to blow up the Dome of the Rock, and they were stopped by the Israeli security services, fortunately. But these fanatics, who are a very small part of the far right-wing, I would say almost lunatic fringe in Israel, have been very noisy and have caused a great deal of trouble because they have aroused serious fears among Muslims that Zionists have secret ambitions to take over the Temple Mount, and that led to riots. It led to counter-violence by Muslims, dropping bricks, for example, throwing stones from the top of the mount down onto Jews praying below at the Wailing Wall, at the Western Wall, and the atmosphere became very, very tense.
Most Jewish worshippers came to mourn the destruction of the first two temples in Jerusalem, but the small, radical Temple Mount Faithful group came to lay the foundation stone for the third, believing the obliteration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque will follow.
In 2000, Ariel Sharon made his controversial visit to the Temple Mount.
The rioting began on Thursday after right-wing opposition leader Ariel Sharon paid a controversial visit to Jerusalem's most contested religious site. Muslims know it as the Haram al-Sharif, Jews as the Temple Mount. Both Israel and the Palestinians demand sovereignty over this holy site. Mr. Sharon's visit was seen as a direct provocation.
Well, Ariel Sharon said Jews can go anywhere we like. That was the point he wanted to make. And he said, even though I'm a minister in the government, this is going to be a purely private visit. Well, the cynicism is beyond belief, because he was accompanied, apparently, by 1,000 police. If Mr. Sharon had gone up there as a private tourist like anyone else, no one would have noticed, no one would have bothered. But he had a huge contingent of armed police. Clearly, he was looking for trouble, and, of course, got it.
The current conflict relates to work the Israelis are undertaking at the Moor's Gate, which involves the removal of earth in order to secure foundations for a new walkway or bridge.
Israeli authorities had been defending new works near the mosque compound as being nothing more than ground repairs needed to secure a walkway to the adjacent Temple Mount. Many who came to protest, though, had little idea exactly what Israeli archaeologists were doing. They're planning to do bad things against Al-Aqsa Mosque, this young man said. What they're doing now is a minor thing, and I think they're testing us for our reaction.
The Temple Mount, Haram al-Sharif, has become a political pawn. It's a question of power. Who controls it? At the moment, within the walls, it's controlled by Islam. All access from the outside is controlled by Israel. And one cannot see, certainly I cannot see, any possible compromise solution. Because if we did hear, for example, what Italy did, creating a little Vatican state in the middle of an Italian city, here one would wish that the Temple Mount might be extraterritorial, accessible to all the Islamic nations, but that they would only have religious dominion, they would not have political control. But I don't think anyone at the moment is in the mood even to consider that.
That's Rear Vision for this week. Today's sound engineer was Roy Huberman. And archival material was provided by ABC Sound Archives. Thanks for joining me. I'm Annabelle Quince.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.